We're doing them out of order. I'm not doing that one.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 25th, 2009. We're going to take the first part of the agenda slightly out of order.
I'm not young enough to
say. We're going to hear House Bill 2088 and 2434 before we hear 2333. So open a public hearing on House Bill 2088.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2088 expands and increases the penalty for knowingly filing a false corporate document with the Secretary of State, makes violations a Class A misdemeanor, declares emergency effective on passage. This one has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It has no revenue impact, and we have not received the fiscal information on this one. There's no amendment. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you. Mr. Threlkeld, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Peter Threlkeld. I'm the Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's Office, and it's my pleasure here to come and speak with you today about House Bill 2088. Really, this is a fairly simple measure. The Division's business registry programs and our function is primarily ministerial. We rely on the honesty and integrity of business filers as they provide information about their businesses. Three of the state's business statutes currently include a penalty for signing a false document. Those statutes are Chapter 60 for business corporations, 63 for limited liability companies, and Chapter 65 for nonprofit corporations. House Bill 28 would extend that penalty provision to about a half dozen other business statutes, and would also increase the penalty from a Class B misdemeanor to a Class A misdemeanor. As we've worked with the Attorney General's office, this is not the type of violation that would really ever warrant prosecution just for its own single incident. This is the type of charge that usually gets levied when there are other larger criminal investigations that are going on, and the law enforcement officials are looking to really throw additional charges at a violator to really change their behavior. So we do not anticipate that this is going to increase any of the prosecutions that are already happening. It's actually our goal that a stronger penalty will act as a greater deterrent, that while the vast majority of Oregon's businessmen and women are honest and law-abiding citizens that are very truthful, those few that choose to do otherwise, we think that this will help to keep them in line and have even fewer violations. With that, I conclude my testimony and
okay, thank you.
Are
any questions? Any questions? Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, it's effective immediately, so, but that doesn't, if you're trying a case, it would not, how does immediate apply in the courtroom situation? It'd be any new cases introduced, or how does that affect?
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnett. That would apply to any new filings. Okay. With our office, so somebody would have to violate the new law, and then a prosecution would come after an investigation.
What kind of numbers do we have that you're experiencing that are falsified? How many people are we dealing with?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, we don't have statistics on how often this happens. Our office will periodically receive claims or allegations that somebody has filed a document that they weren't supposed to, or that they were misleading or dishonest in the document. We work with the Attorney General's office on those, but it's not a really widespread problem, in my opinion. It does happen, and our approach has been to try to make sure that all of our forms disclose that there is some consequence and some penalty if documents are falsified. So we try to make sure that people are aware of the law and abide by the law.
Mr. Chair,
I'd like to have some figures. In other words, what have you experienced in 05, 07, and 08 or something, so we know kind of what you're experiencing, that this is really needed. And also, I'd like you to tell us how do nonprofits that have to file these type of papers, what type of false information would they give that, and who becomes responsible for the fine on a nonprofit? Would it be the board or the director, or what is it?
The nonprofits are currently accountable. There is a false signing penalty in the nonprofit law, so they're currently under that provision. It would be the filer, so whoever, whether it's the incorporator that was filing the document or the officers that were providing updated information. I'm not aware that there's ever been a problem with a nonprofit or any numbers there. I would say from my own experience, we probably see 3 to 4 filings or cases a year where somebody has filed information and falsified information or is alleged to have falsified information. So it doesn't happen a lot, but I know in a recent case that we've discussed with the Attorney General's office, there's been an individual that provided false information, and there were anywhere from 10 to 20 different business registrations that were involved.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Treagle, was that how you?
Treadkill.
Treadkill, thank you. Treadkill. I'm concerned about, you know, I think we have so many new LLCs that are one-person people and small, but here, you know, I don't see a proportionality to $6,500 if someone didn't change address or something like that. The bill doesn't address the severity of what we're going to be doing here for $6,500. I'm a little uncomfortable with this. Can you address?
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnett. Failure to update an address or is really not the intent, I think, of the statute as it currently exists, or in this case as it's rewritten for LLCs. It's really, that would be a case of an individual who was operating the LLC, but they provided the name of John Smith or something other than themselves, so that they were able to try to conceal their identity and circumvent the law.
Thank you.
Representative Stiegler.
Right. And I'm just to be really clear here, Mr. Threlkeld, what you're trying to do through this is to bring some uniformity to the entire area of business corporate filings with the corporations division, so that there's consistency across the board. Is that that's
Chair
how I'm reading it?
Parker, Representative Stiegler, that is correct.
Okay.
Hey, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as somebody who files many annual reports for limited liability companies, I want to compliment, first of all, the people who work in the front office at the Secretary of State's Corporation Division for the fine work and service that they do. In the department, they're always really friendly and do a great job. And to follow up on this, this would be, for example, when an individual noticed that they've made a mistake, there's still plenty of opportunity to go back in and refile an amended update. And we're not talking about those things here. We're talking about people who are, I think last session we were looking at people who were setting up even out of state or using shell companies and those types of things so that we couldn't get at them. Is that what we're talking about here?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, yes, exactly. This is part of a larger effort that our office has been working with law enforcement to look at misuse of shell companies, people that are willfully violating the law, trying to conceal identities. This is not meant to be a trap for the unwary or to as any way to punish Oregon's honest business men and women.
Thank you.
So I would say that, you know, our office, being ministerial, doesn't have the authority to initiate prosecutions. that would come from the Attorney General's office. So even in a violation, we couldn't say we're gonna go after you. We'd have to present that evidence to the Attorney General's office, and they would have to decide to take on the investigation or prosecution.
This law.
Yeah. The existing laws and this law, yes.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
I would want some more specificity to this, because I can remember a legislator who was fined $7,600 by the Secretary of State's office for a one-day late filing with a figure wrong, with no criminal intent, and they just nailed him. And I don't want that type of conduct from the Secretary of State's office to come into this to the people. It's bad enough we got to put up with it.
As a ministerial office in our business registry function, we have no authority to implement or initiate these penalties. That would something that would have to come from the Attorney General's office. We would simply pass along information if we became aware of a potential violation, and then we leave it up to the AG's office to investigate and decide if criminal prosecution or penalty is warranted.
This would require actually a criminal prosecution before these came into effect. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Stiegler.
And Mr. Thrawkell, just to be clear again, these would be for knowingly signing a document, basically falsifying a document. It would be something that they had knowledge of, and that it's a false statement somehow on the document. I don't care where on the document it is, but it's knowingly filing a false document with your division.
That is correct.
Which is not essentially the mistaken kind of, you know.
Right. It's not meant to trap people with mistakes. It's really to be able to have a better tool for the Attorney General and law enforcement to enforce law where fraudulent activity is taking place.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We don't have a fiscal back on this, so I'll close the public hearing on 2088 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2434.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2434 decreases the statute of ultimate repose for large commercial structures from 10 years to 6 years. There is a dash one amendment that exempts homeowners associations or associations of unit owners, and that would maintain the 10-year statute of ultimate repose. We have no revenue impact and have no information on the fiscal yet. Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
There is no fiscal yet.
There's no information yet.
Okay. Mr. Higgs, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Drew Hagedorn on behalf of the Associated General Contractors in support of House Bill 2434. I think it's fair to say that for our members, this is among the top priorities for AGC this legislative session, and that stands to reason. Oregon's commercial construction industry is struggling to acquire required insurance coverage to build our local communities. Over the last decade, we've seen skyrocketing liability insurance costs that are having devastating impacts on our membership. In some instances, coverage cannot be obtained. As costs have risen, the amount of available coverage has decreased, and exclusions on policies continue to expand. In short, we're getting far less and paying far more. In addition to other cost considerations, Oregon's insurance market represents only about 1% of the national insurance market. We're not a California that can have a regulatory structure that distinguishes itself from other states. And Oregon has a 10-year statute of ultimate repose currently. Washington, by our neighbor, by contrast, has a 6-year statute of repose. Their statute applies in both the commercial context as well as the residential context. Our bill only applies to the commercial sector, and I'll get to more of that later. So House Bill 2434 seeks to improve the insurance market in Oregon by having a level of our statute of ultimate repose comparable to other states such as Washington. Again, it's from 10 years to 6 years. It would not apply to residential structures. We recognize the arguments that we've heard in prior legislative sessions. We've advanced this proposal that residential purchasers are not as sophisticated as a commercial purchaser. So we sought to address that by excluding the residential sector. We also worked with stakeholders throughout the interim and early part of the this legislative session to craft a compromise with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, which in the past has raised objections with our bill. And that compromise is encapsulated by the -1 amendments to the bill. As your counsel indicated, the -1 amendments would retain a 10-year statute of repose for instances where a condominium association or an HOA, a homeowners association, is involved. We recognize that the owners in those contexts, while living in a commercial structure per se, are really more residential owners, and that it made sense to retain the 10-year statute in those contexts. One of the documents that I passed out to you this afternoon relates to House Bill 3242, which was promulgated and approved by the legislature during the 2007 legislative session. And while that's not before you today, I do believe it's very much germane to this topic. House Bill 3242 did a number of things, but foremost, it sought to separate commercial from residential under our CCB licensing code. And the idea of that bill was that it would work hand in glove with this proposal. The bill, in addition to separating residential from commercial, raised the standard of practice in the commercial construction industry. It had continuing education requirements. It had experience requirements incorporated in it, all with an eye towards preventing problems before they happened. It also sought to protect commercial owners by increasing bonding requirements, in addition to a new 2-year building envelope lap warranty. A lot of the problems we've seen in the past with commercial structures have been related to water intrusion because of the wrap. Here again, the idea is to have a policy in place where you're actually monitoring that and making sure that the structure is intact. So 3242, while not before you today, I think is very much germane to this topic. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and answer any questions that you may have.
Questions? We looked at this before. Now you worked with the trial lawyers to get the compromise.
That's right.
And I'm just... Okay.
And we haven't heard any objections from the Commercial Real Estate Association, NEOP, or for that matter, BOMA, the Building Owners and Managers Association. LOC, the League of Oregon Cities, hasn't raised any issue. I understand just moments ago that the Association of Oregon Counties may have a concern, but beyond that, we're not aware of anybody that takes issue with this bill.
Okay. Representative Wisnack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Washington State is 6 years.
That's correct.
And California?
I think California has an 8-year statute. Don't quote me on that, though. I'd have to do some additional research there. The difference between Oregon and California is that California is a massive state. If you're going to be in this business, you're going to be there. And our real function here is to make sure that we have not only mitigate the cost of our insurance, but we have more insurance companies writing business here so we can go out and shop for policies and get a more of a competitive atmosphere.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Snyder, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. Appearing today in opposition to House Bill 2434, we've discussed this among county councils with respect to the changes the bill would make. I have a particular example that I'd like to share with you about why this continues to be a problem for counties. Several years ago, the Lincoln County Jail was constructed, and in that construction project, there were defects in the construction. Lincoln County Council indicated that in the case of the defects that they had, they were not evident for a number of years. They had internal leaks. Especially the extent of the defects was not discoverable until we had a forensic engineer rip apart the skin to reveal internal damage. This was only done after repeated attempts to get our contractors to fix cosmetic, externally discoverable leak problems we tried year after year without overall success. Fix one leak, and then the next year others would pop up. Given that the leaks occurred seasonally and only in some seasons, he puts in parentheses, our sideways rain, i.e. not every year, 6 years would not have been sufficient to determine the extent of the problem. The defects were both design and construction. Finally, brought claims that, in which the architect, the contractor, the subcontractors, each denied that they were individually responsible, but all agreed that defects needed to be remedied. He indicates that they were a classic example of the situation where where the individual or the entity that's contracting with the contractor actually does this kind of construction project very seldom. It's the contractor who does it often or all the time. And the difficulty in understanding and diagnosing these types of problems when you don't do it very frequently, I think, is rather evident. And we do construction of this magnitude very seldom. Defects were in the building envelope and not self-evident. We attempted to correct what appeared on the surface, but only a number of years were able to discover the extent of the defects and act on them for the public good. Another reference that we have indicates that new and remodeled schools, for example, would be out of luck if the defects were discovered after 6 years after substantial completion. And the observation was made that with envelope defects in particular, discovery after 6 years is common. Mr. Chair, that's all I have.
So why not 8? I mean, we're, you know, we sort of pick these numbers, and the construction industry is looking for their liability, you know, to control their liability. If 6 years is not long enough, would the 8 years of California be enough, or do you have any idea on that?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I think maybe we can have a conversation with the proponents of the bill and see if there's anything that we could do to deal with the problem that we know about with respect to the Lincoln County Jail and still reduce the cost of liability insurance for the people who do these construction projects.
I mean, this thing's been kind of underway, so I was a little surprised, you know, to learn of opposition today. I wish, I guess, well, if there, we'll have other questions too, but
Drew wants to come up.
If you want to come up.
Mr. Chair, we didn't know that there was a task force. We testified against the same bill last legislative session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one thing I wanted to add is that the 6 years were picked for a specific reason, and that was because Washington, as I mentioned, 6 years also happens to be the statute of limitations for contracts. So for an original owner, our bill doesn't really have a significant impact, at least that's from our perspective. In the instance of a local government, they'd be we'd be off the hook after 6 years because they have a 6-year statute of limitation for a contract claim. At least that's what I've been indicated by our counsel. Now maybe we should confirm that, but I don't really see many instances where we'd be building a prison or a school and the state would choose to, or a local government would choose to transfer that right to a subsequent purchaser.
Any further questions? Representative Smith.
My first response is, oh, crap. My understanding had been this is pretty much a consensus bill, and, you know, so I'll just toot my data horn. It would be valuable for me, and I don't know sort of what timeline we're on, but it would be valuable for me to see data about, you know, to see if you're concerned, see the degree of legitimacy of your concern about, you know, at what point relating to Representative Barker's Chair Barker's question, is it, you know, what's the difference between 6 and 8 in terms of the lives of real people and the operations of real businesses? And I understand in terms of getting favorable, you know, favorable insurance rates. I sort of understand that side of the equation, but for the other side of the equation, that would be helpful, and to understand and try to relate it to the statute of limitations on contracts. It is. The statute to propose, it's not starting upon discovery. It's starting upon just completion, just like sufficient, you know, substantial completion of the project, right? So the difference might be with a contract, like I know, you know, sort of what's in the contract, and if there's a violation of the contract, I think the statute starts running upon discovery of the breach of the, you know, upon the breach of the contract, not upon the draft of the contract. Is that
you're
true?
Right. That's correct.
Right. So the difference here is, you know, so I draft a contract with my friend Representative Cameron, and, you know, 6 years later, 6 years and one day later, I breach it because I'm a big jerk, right? He then still has, you know, time to go after me for that breach of the contract, right? Whereas here, my understanding is it's not upon discovery. It's just what building's done or not. If I find out, you know, 6 years and one day later that it's, you know, that you guys put worms in the walls, which I don't think you probably do, and I don't know why you would have done, but let's just say you did, then I'd have, you know, negative days to go after it. So I did have some policy questions about this, and now I have them again. Oh, crap.
Chair Barker.
Yes.
I would echo Representative Smith's concerns.
Hey, we don't have a fiscal on this one either, do we? Okay, thank you. If you want to discuss a little more, we don't have a fiscal today, so we can't work it today. Probably schedule it for a work session pretty quickly, but when we get it back, we're either going to move it or not move it. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2434. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2333.
Good afternoon, everyone. House Bill 2333 was actually carried from yesterday. We heard this back on the 5th of February. This is a bill that would allow a grand jury to receive an evidence and affidavit authenticating the records of a financial institution. There's no fiscal impact. There's no revenue impact. And just to briefly refresh everyone, Brad Berry, I believe, is the only person who testified on this back on the 5th of February.
Help refresh me again on this. So this would allow, what does this change?
What this allows is, and especially in cases that include credit card fraud, ID theft, this allows the prosecutors to bring in a letter from the bank or the financial institution that says these records are kept in the ordinary course of business, here are the records, and just for the purposes of grand jury, introduce those without having to call a representative from the financial institution. Typically, their testimony is going to be very brief. It's going to be what I just said. Yeah. We keep these. This is what they are. And you may have to find them out of state. I mean, it can be very convoluted. So this just will make the process go faster, but it won't change anything for the actual criminal trial process.
Okay, thank you. We're ready to go then.
Yeah.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2333 and open a work session on House Bill 2333. Is there any discussions?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2333 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2333 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Excuse.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Excused.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Representative Barton.
Aye.
Thank you. Motion carries.
Move the consent calendar.
Okay. Representative Cameron asked that we move this to the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Go
open a work session on House Bill 2175.
And again, for a recap on this, House Bill 2175 broadened the class of non-Oregon convictions or adjudications that require reporting. This is part of the package of Walsh Act bills. We adopted the Dash 1 amendments back on, we had the hearing on February 4th. We have a minimal expenditure, there is no revenue impact, and at the original hearing, only Vi Beatty testified.
So this is in the event of an out-of-state?
This is if you were convicted out-of-state, you are not on supervision, and you move back to Oregon. This would bring us into compliance with Walsh.
Okay.
Is there a motion?
Is there any discussion? I'll accept a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2175 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2175 to the floor with a due pass. Further discussion, hearing none. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Bolton?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Excuse.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. We probably ought to have explained that one on the floor. Is there anybody, would anybody like to be the carrier? Representative Stiegler, would you carry it? Thank you. Representative Stiegler will be the carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 2175 and open a work session on House Bill 2173.
Oh, my apologies, Mr. Chair. We did not receive fiscals in time for 2173 or 2269,
okay.
So they have been reposted for March 3rd.
Okay.
Which ones?
2173 and 2269.
Okay, close the work session on 2173 and open a work session on House Bill 2187.
And House Bill 2187, this is the bill that would allow the Oregon Youth Authority to request fingerprints from persons applying to operate youth offender foster homes. There's a Dash 2 amendment. The issue when the amendments came up was who would be fingerprinted in the household, so you should have the Dash 2s in front of you for discussion. There is minimal expenditure and no revenue impact.
And the amendment takes care of the question of do we fingerprint the five-month-old baby and so on. It inserts an adult member of the applicant's household as defined by rule. Is there any discussion about the amendment? I'd accept a motion to adopt the amendment. Representative Smith moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2187. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And next, I'd accept a motion to move House Bill 2187 to the floor with a due pass.
Chair, I move we move 2187 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2187 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Excuse.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Garrett, would you carry that one for us?
Sure.
Thank you. And then we open a open a public hearing on, or I mean a work session on House Bill 2310.
And House Bill 2310 would allow a party to request modification of a protective order for good cause. There is a Dash 1 amendment that you're seeing for the first time. Here as well, in case the committee would like any explanation about what the changes are in the amendment.
As I recall, this one was to allow a party to request modification as long as they weren't harassing somebody, and of course the court would take a look at that, and line 8 says for good cause shown, and that we're entered under for good cause shown under ORS 107. 21781A, B, G, and I. Petitioner may request that the court modify by removing or making less restrictive terms of the order than were entered essentially originally. Is that correct? Do you have anything to add to that?
I do not.
Is there any questions about that?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that there's consensus on this amendment. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they did the work. Okay. Right. Cool. I'll entertain a motion to adopt the dash ones.
So moved.
Representative Stiegler moves we adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2310. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so accept the motion to move House Bill 2310 as amended to the floor to do pass. Representative Smith moves House Bill 2310 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any objection or discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Excuse me.
Aye. Oh, I'm sorry. I got tons of notes here.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
And now he's excused.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisden?
Excused.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson will carry that. Is there any further business to come before the committee?
Don't worry, because it's not as bad as being called Madam Chair twice in one hearing.
That's not as bad.
You did. Got called Madam Chair twice.
Nothing further before the
Holby, I guess.
Committee? Holby. Committee's adjourned.
All right.
I like it.
Love this committee.
No.